Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Pai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So this is the final episode of my coverage from Augmented World Expo, and this is the Socratic dialogue in the future of immersive tech, especially XR and AI. We did the first version of this last year with myself, Louis Rosenberg, Alvin Graylin, and Leslie Shannon, and we decided to do it again just because it was a very dynamic conversation, and both Leslie and Alvin are very pro-AI in a way that they are really trying to emphasize the positive aspects of AI. I think Louis and I are a little bit more on the anti-AI, although it's weird because Louis is a bit of an AI doomer, concerned around artificial general intelligence, artificial superintelligence, but I think also falls into different aspects of propagating dimensions of AI hype that I think are undue. He would call me an AI denialist in terms of like I'm denying the dangers of artificial superintelligence. And I think my pushback is that there's a whole paper by Dr. Johnny Penn that's called Inventing Intelligence that I'd highly recommend folks check out to kind of dig into more of this argument, which is that artificial intelligence is like a marketing term that has a whole legacy of bad citation practices of these technologists who were kind of leaning on turning the mind into a computing metaphor. You know, from the very beginning, these computer scientists were kind of ignoring what was happening in physiology and cognitive science and basically taking these metaphors of computation and projecting them into what it means to be human. And so there's a lot of ways that I think Louis is also treating the mind and brain as a computer and reifying different aspects of intelligence onto this number that can be replicated by different aspects of machines that can be way more capable of a human. And I think that the danger is that there's aspects of humanity that go way beyond what can be reified into a certain number that can be quantified as intelligence, that there's actually all sorts of dimensions of what it actually means to be human. What it means to be human includes dimensions of our emotions, our physicality, our embodied experiences, our relationality, our intentions, our wills, our desires, our contextual dimensions, our relational dimensions, our meaning, you know, all sorts of things that are just not in AI. And so Louis is talking about like, oh, it's a control feedback loop cycle. And so these control systems are these computational metaphors that I think unduly collapse the sophistication of what it means to be human. One example is like this concept of John Vervaeke and relevance realization, which is that how do you decide what's relevant from moment to moment? And this is something that humans do based upon our prior experience, our memories, our emotions, our lived experiences, all these sort of like things that concress from a process philosophy perspective. There's this idea of concrescence, which is like pulling in all the past data and information and have our own sorting mechanism. We have a way of orienting in the OODA loop from Boyd. You have orient, observe, decide, act. That orientation dimension is what John Vervaeke calls relevance realization. That's something that AI cannot do in a sophisticated way. And so there's things that humans can do that computers can't. And what Vervaeke is saying is that's not a computational process that can be replicated and mimicked. It's something that's unique to like living organisms that we have that relevance realization that computation doesn't have. So I think there's a nuance of this discussion that starts to conflate what it means to be human and what it means to be a machine that is this broader discussion about AI that is these larger debates. And so there's a number of different scholars and people that I'm referring to when I am saying this, and I'm saying some of it in real time, but I'm going to try to point to some other resources that if you want more information from like Emily Mbender and Alex Hanna's The AI Con, or Karen Howell's The Empire of AI, or this documentary that's going to be coming out here at some point that premiered at Sundance, it's called Ghost of the Machine. There's also Resisting AI, An Anti-Fascist Approach to Artificial Intelligence by Dan McQuillan. There's also a book by Jonathan Roberg and Michael Castelli called The Cultural Life of Machine Learning, An Incursion to Critical AI Studies. So there's lots of like sociologists, anthropologists, cognitive scientists, and other folks that are not necessarily always from the field of technology that folks from technology fields have this kind of paradigm that things are moving so quickly that they shouldn't be looking at what's happening in the social sciences. And they make all these conflations about what the nature of intelligence is in a way that is just kind of collapsing the complexity of the sociological and technological processes of what it means to have knowledge production and the nature of what it means to be human. There's actually all sorts of dimensions of AI that includes the human production of data and knowledge that is being extracted. And so much of the machine learning is coming from data that comes from humans. And without that data, AI would be nothing. So it ended up feeling like a bit of, at times, 3-1 on this panel discussion, which, you know, it's fine. I think that there's a bit of me taking this more extreme position where I'm saying that it's unethical to use these particularly large language models of these huge hyperscaler companies that are in bed with a democratically backsliding authoritarianism in a way that, if uncritically used, is further consolidating this wealth and power that is leading towards this kind of authoritarian tendencies. You know, AI does not have to be inevitable, and that there's all sorts of different dimensions that AI is not in right relationship to the world around us, and that we have to figure out a way to have the different guardrails and privacy protections and in the political context that doesn't necessarily lead towards this common good economy that Mariana Mazzucato is writing about in her book, The Common Good Economy, is leading more towards this democratically backsliding authoritarianism, which means that these big tech companies have no guardrails to stop them from basically consolidating their wealth and power in a way that is, I think, going to be pretty detrimental to our democracy and our privacy. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this Socratic dialogue with myself, Lewis, Alvin, and Leslie happened on Thursday, June 18th, 2026 at the Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the last panel of the last day before the closing speech from Ori. So we're tasked with entertaining you for an hour. But for those of you who came last year, we've been doing, this is our third year?
Second year, sorry.
it just feels so long. Essentially, what we're going to have a little bit different than most discussions, that we're creating what we call a Socratic dialogue. And it's a bit of a debate, but it's really a debate for constructive understanding so that we can get to hopefully a better common ground and better understanding of the overall landscape and the technology and its impact on our society. And the way we've actually structured it is that it goes from very maybe anti-AI and a little bit more pessimistic about technology to maybe a little bit more optimistic.
Or more pro-humanity on this side and anti-humanity on that side.
Yeah, well, you know, whichever way you want to position it.
Oh, the gloves are off from moment one.
Yeah, so we, you know, in the back we were saying we're going to kind of keep it low-key to start. But in any case, I think, you know, the key is we're here to help bring greater understanding. And I wanted to start off with maybe kind of upgrading it, because in the last year, there's been a lot of change, right? Both in the XR space, as well as particularly in the AI space, in terms of where the technology has gone. And it'd be good to really understand kind of where our various panelists see this new change. So let's start with that. So maybe, Ken, can you talk about what you see in just 1 minute of where do you think the technology has changed in the last year, and has it gone better or worse?
Yeah, so I rewatched the session from last year, and in talking to my fellow panelists, I feel like I was talking about how AI is a lot about the consolidation of wealth and power. And so I think there's a lot of ways in which that I think my fellow panelists are maybe sort of leaning into the way that there's a democratically backsliding authoritarianism that we have in the United States, and that mixed with surveillance capitalism and this melding with this lack of privacy laws in the United States means that we're kind of sleepwalking into a sort of Big Brother situation without those legal protections. I'm sort of taking a position that it's unethical to be using AI in a way that until we have those guardrails in place. And so we have to sort of set up with our own moral intuition for how to rationalize why to use this AI that uses data colonialism, that is, in a way, you know, there's a lot of pragmatism where people say that it works, but there's a lot of harms that are happening with AI that I think that we'll probably agree with a lot of those harms. But I think the difference is I've made a personal choice that I feel like I have blood on my hands when I use AI. And so I choose not to use it.
Okay. So, Lewis, what's your take?
Sure. So last year I talked about being very nervous about AI and about really the future of superintelligence and the impacts of that on humanity and just on what it means to be an individual when there is a superintelligence that we know is smarter than us. I also talked about the potential dangers of direct human manipulation when AI and XR converge, and we have basically super intelligent systems riding shotgun in our lives, in our glasses, in our earbuds, on pendants that can speak to us and potentially manipulate us on behalf of powers that be, or just manipulate us algorithmically. Over the last 12 months, I would say that I'm more concerned. I'm more concerned because AI is advancing even faster than I thought it would last year. And we're also seeing the convergence of AI being piped into people's heads even sooner than I thought. And so to me, we've moved further down the dangerous path. Now, where I diverge from Ken is I don't advocate not using AI. I see that as kind of sticking your head in the sand. And I've actually really gone the exact opposite route, which is I'm pretty anti-AI, and yet I've spent the last 12 years running an AI company. And that AI company is focused on keeping humans in the loop. And I really would hope that there were even more in the AI space working very hard to empower humans and keep humans in the loop as opposed to replace humans. But that transition has not happened as quickly as I would hoped on a large scale.
Great. Leslie, maybe you can give your perspectives.
I'm still optimistic about what AI can do for us. And I will always be using it. It is an indispensable tool. However, I think the way that it's being implemented here, specifically in the United States, is a problem because it is everything is about money and humanity has completely been lost. So Kent, your anti-humanity is actually not accurate. And to contrast this, I've retired and my husband and I are moving back to Europe. And so I spent the last 3 months in France and I actually had a health scare. I started getting posterior vitreal detachment, which means the vitreous humor in my eye was detaching from the retina. And the retina can tear in that situation. And if you don't get seen by an ophthalmologist within 48 hours, you can lose your vision. And so that happened to me. And we were in France, and I had no effing idea what to do about it. But I went to ChatGPT, and ChatGPT told me how serious it was. It told me how to navigate the French healthcare system as a tourist, and it saved my vision. So I will never, AI as a tool is unbelievably powerful. However, running it for money is wrong, the same way running a medical system for money is wrong. And I think this is also linking back into what I'm seeing in the XR world. I think one of the problems that we have is the fickleness of platforms. Because the large companies are making their decisions based on money, and they're turning things off. RIP alt space, Meta has made some very consequential decisions that have affected the lives of thousands of people casually, as far as I can tell, based on money. And as long as that continues here in the United States, I think we're going to have problems. I'm seeing a much greater focus on humanity in Europe and in Asia, and so that's actually where my hope lies.
Great. Well, I think there's a clear spectrum of positions on this technology, and I'm probably in the middle in the sense of I've worked on AI my entire career, AI and XR, and I am a big believer in the potential of this technology to do transformative good. So I think we should be using it, but the key is to use it responsibly, to make sure that it's good for society, and to use it with a more global perspective versus right now, the use of AI and the development of AI in America is very America-centric, and it's about America winning, whereas I really see both technologies as a way to elevate humanity. So if we can take the perspective that AI is a public good and actually immersive technology as well, and they actually come together to reinforce some of the issues that each other provide to society. And both technologies have actually accelerated in their development over the last year in terms of, I think anybody who's using these tools realize how capable they are compared to what they were a year ago. And now, not just being a chatbot, but being agents. And in fact, now doing drug discovery and solving, you know, math problems that have eluded humans for 100 years, right? So those kind of capabilities are there. And now with the inclusion of personalized sensors and glasses and pins and rings and all this data that we are now sending into these AI systems, which, you know, whether you're Google or your Meta or your Apple, they're all starting to create personalized AI. And the key is that AI working for the user or is that AI working for the corporation? And I think these are the kind of concerns that I think many of us have. So actually, I want to start back on this side and say, before we get into the disagreements,
Ken's ready.
I feel like I'm ready to get into it. I feel like I just want to reply to one thing, which is that this whole idea of personalized AI is a nightmare in terms of contextually aware AI is terrible because Hal Nissenbaum has a theory of contextual integrity, which when you go to a doctor's office, you share doctor's information. When you go to your bank, you share bank information. The idea that an AI would be flattening all those contexts means that we have no contextual integrity of privacy. So it's basically eliminating all privacy. So contextually aware AI is like a privacy nightmare.
Well, I don't disagree with you, but if it's used properly, it could also be quite valuable.
And actually, where I lived in Europe before was in Finland, where actually a lot of this information is centrally held by the government. And it's incredibly wonderful to go into, if you get sick in a remote corner of Finland, you can walk into any doctor's office and they instantly have your information there. However, they also do speeding tickets based on your income tax return from the previous year, which I know from experience. And so if you get a speeding ticket, the police officer will go back to their car and look up your income tax return from the previous year, and it's a percentage of that that is your fine. And that's been going on in Finland for decades already. So that is probably your worst nightmare.
In Europe, they have GDPR. They have actual privacy law.
Right.
There is no comprehensive privacy law in the United States. It's meaning that the Fourth Amendment has this definition between what's public and private. And there's a third-party doctrine interpretation of the Fourth Amendment. It means that any data you gave to a third party has no reasonable expectation to remain private, which means any data you give to a cloud, the government can get access to the data without any sort of warrant, which means that we basically have Big Brother surveillance right now. Like, the government could go to OpenAI, Anthropic, and get every single thing you've told it. And there's nothing to stop them from doing that. So it's basically like a vast surveillance that we already have in place. If you look at what came out this year with the documentation, they said, oh, we're using the Fourth Amendment to protect data. But it's like, if you know anything about the third-party doctrine, there's actually no protection at all. So what I'm saying is that anything you say and put onto a cloud, there's no privacy protections.
And I think it comes back to trust. I'll just, so real quick. People in America don't trust the government, and people in Finland do. And I think that's the difference.
But if you look at this issue of contextually aware AI, and you also look at the trajectory of the XR space, which, as Leslie said, we've seen parts of the XR space really collapse and other parts are strong. What's strong happens to be the places where very large companies are going to put cameras on your body and voices in your heads. And so when you're talking about the data that we're worried about, the world that big tech envisions is a world where we're walking around and everything we see and do and hear is being tracked. And that's an even more dangerous world, especially when there's an AI that can be talking in our ears based on everything we see and do and hear.
Because you're concerned about manipulation, yes?
Well, I'm concerned about manipulation, but also there's the privacy issues and there's the tracking issues. And, you know, you talk about insurance based on your income tax. What if it's insurance based on what the AI saw you do with your life, right? You know, you're living dangerously. It's your fault. And that data will be tracked. Like, that is the world we are entering into without protection.
Yeah, and this does come back to kind of what Leslie's saying about the role of government here, right? And whether the role of government is to help the people or is it to help the companies? And right now in America, the role of government is really to help the companies grow faster. That seems to be the priority, whereas the roles in maybe parts of Europe and parts of Asia is to keep the people safer and keep a more stable society. So it's the objective of that. And also, when in America, if the technology is focused on improving profits, then everything that it is doing is going to make you, you know, engage more or provide information to sell you something or to manipulate you to do something. Whereas if the policy is there to say this data can only be used by the individual for the individual to help the individual for their own purpose, then a lot of the concerns may not be as strong as when it's being misused.
But, you know, one of my fears, though, is a big part of the reason that Europe does actually focus much more on the humanity, and GDPR makes a huge difference, actually, as opposed to the United States, is that Europe went through World War II. And so it's after World War II that we saw the human-aware governments of Europe arise. And now, unfortunately, we're getting far enough away from World War II that everybody who lived it is, like, dying. Yeah. And so that memory is no longer with us. So, but are we capable in the United States of becoming more humanity-focused without actually having to start shooting at each other?
Well, so after World War II was sort of the genesis of human rights in the way that there was legal protections for what you can and cannot do. And so that's a deontological ethical system, meaning you have a rules saying that you can and cannot do this. And so the de facto ethical moral system of AI is utilitarian. And so as I talked to Daniel Ufer of Access Now, he talks about how with this kind of default utilitarianism, they say, well, this works like for 90% of the cases or even maybe 70% of the time. But for the 5% or 30% of the people that it doesn't work for, those are the people that are already marginalized in a way that harm is embedded into this systemic bias that's amplified by all these AI systems. And so it may work for you, but it may also be amplifying harm for people who don't happen to be in the training model. So that's what Joy Boimano's coded bias, and she's a Black AI researcher that her face wasn't in the AI training data. It couldn't recognize her face until she put up this white mask, and then she was recognized. And so there's this kind of de facto utilitarianism that is, I use it because it's work and it's practical, but where's the harm? And I think that's the thing that we've lost our moral intuition to see, like, what are the costs to the environment, to people, to data colonization, to all the people where that data was stolen, and all the energy aspects. And also we have all these hyperscalers that are like in bed with a democratically backsliding authoritarianism where we can't trust what data they're giving over to them. So these hyperscalers are like buying up all the RAM, all the storage. So we have a future of techno-feudalism where we're not going to own any hardware. So I feel like we're in this future where you just like have this Sam Altman and all these companies in bed with sort of a democratically backsliding authoritarianism that they're basically going to do whatever they want with no oversight from the government at all.
So I do want to challenge that assumption that hyperscaler is the key to success of a country or a company, in the sense of the optimization of these models now are becoming so amazing that every year you're getting about 40 times efficiency in terms of the same intelligence for the same number of essentially tokens per watts. And what that really means is that over a year, essentially what can run on my phone right now was top of the line that was running on a rack of servers in a data center a year ago. And in another year, what's there today in data centers will run on my phone, right? Which means that the ability to do edge-based compute and edge-based processing where you can maintain a lot more privacy is becoming more and more realistic. And while still giving frontier level or maybe, you know, 1 year old frontier level capabilities to most humans. And the reality is that the level today, even if we had made no progress in AI for another year, it would be more than enough for making significant economic progress and growth in our society. Right? So I don't think that the companies who right now believe that when they get to AGI, they will be able to maintain their supremacy because they have the data center access. I don't think that that formula is really realistic.
Well, and Alvin, you actually wrote a terrific article just last month, The Mirage of AI.
The Windfall Mirage
of AI, right. And so I'm going to steal your point here because it was so good. And Alvin's point was the data centers of the world are infrastructure. And what we see repeatedly in cycles of new technology is infrastructure, new infrastructure gets all the attention and all the investment at the beginning. But then as time goes on, it's the services that are built on that infrastructure that actually take all the value. Now, I come from the world of infrastructure. I come from the telecommunications world. And by God, we saw that. Because when mobile first came out, you know, oh my God, everybody, you know, stock prices go up and it was building out the networks and so much money, woo. And then once the networks were there, all the money shifted to the services that were running on the networks, Netflix, everything else. And the telcos are sitting there going, hey.
Yeah, they spent all their money on 5G.
Yeah, we
got
built
nothing.
These networks. What the heck? You know, how come the money's not flowing to us anymore?
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see a similar thing with the data centers. Yeah. And so right now we're in the, you know, all the money is being showered on them. But XR is one of the key services that will be built on this. So I have great hope that the windfall will come to us.
Yeah. So a lot of the concern over ecology is actually something that I think is a relatively temporary issue, is I think the key point, because the economy will figure out that building these data centers is unnecessary. And when that stops and they will continue to optimize these models, you get more capability, more bang for your buck on what's already there.
So I just want to push back on some of the focus on data centers and hyperscalers and even the practices of some companies that maybe we would like to behave better, because that gets so much of the attention of the dangers of AI that we don't focus on, well, even if everything goes right and we achieve superintelligence, whether it's in 2 years or 5 years, you know, we could slow down a little bit. We don't focus on what does that really mean to humans, when there's an AI that is significantly smarter than all of us. And I think that the idea that it will be demoralizing to humans is real. I mean, you could imagine a world where almost everybody's profession is impacted in a way where they are a supervisor of an AI and not actually doing the work. And so you could imagine, and combine it with XR, imagine a world where you're wearing AI glasses and you're a physician and you're examining a patient and there's a super intelligence that's seeing the patient as you see it and whispering in your ears. And your job as the physician becomes to write the prescription and to take on the liability, but the AI is actually, you know, doing the work for you. That is a reasonable reality, and I don't think we appreciate that that's potentially demoralizing. Now, maybe there's different ways that, that things evolve, but it is a risk that gets lost because we're so focused on the how we get there rather than what does it really mean to get there.
I want to just, as the person that's on this far end, bring in Emily Endbinder, Alex Hanna, the AI con book, or there's a movie called The Ghost of the Machine, Karen Howell's The Empire of AI, and Dr. Johnny Penn's Inventing Intelligence dissertation. So in Emily Endbinder and Alex Hanna, they point out that AI is a marketing term that's basically the beginning of AI as a term was always used to get money from the DoD, and it does a dual harm. It dehumanizes us to say that Sam Altman saying, your kid is never going to be as smart as an AI. That is totally dehumanizing. Secondly, it's like projecting human intelligence onto AI where it's not merited. And so there's a eugenicist history of AI, IQ, G factor that they dig into in The Ghost of the Machine, which is that this whole kind of hierarchy of intelligence was like people that were on the lower end of that IQ test were being sterilized. And so when I hear, Lewis, when I hear you say super intelligence and that, oh, we're never going to be smart, it sort of invokes a sort of hierarchy that AI is asking us to really question what is uniquely human and what is a machine. And we're sort of treating these AIs as like gods, that they're so much smarter than us and we're never being as smart. But intelligence, the AIs is just one aspect of the human experience. Alfred North Whitehead is a process philosopher, and he's a pan-experientialist. He's looking at the whole breadth of the human experience, which includes relationships and meaning and depth and emotion, and like there's agency and intention and will, and there's our body and our sensory experience. None of that that AI has. It's just sort of an abstraction of that. And so AI as a term is something that we should question because it's just basically a whole mix of undefined technologies that we are using to anthropomorphize and then have these people like Sam Altman are saying, your kid is never going to be as smart as an AI, which is sort of has this dehumanizing factor.
Yeah, but I think you are rooting in wishful thinking that AI is not advancing as quickly as it is and that it's not getting embodied, and it is. It's getting, we're going to be the ones embodying it, carrying it around on our shoulders.
I guess the question is, what is our relationship to these technologies? Is it a tool, or is it something that becomes a power over us that's making choices for us in a way that we lose our agency?
And I think we very easily could lose our agency.
And it's a black box that we don't have any insight for how it's actually making any decisions. And so there's this, I think, what is it that makes us uniquely human and what is AI? And there's this conflation that's happening right now that's totally dehumanizing. And I feel it when I go onto Facebook and I see all this AI slop where it's like, oh, numbers going up according to the Facebook execs. When I see this, it's like, that's not being a human. This is like non-consensually like hijacking my attention to like serve novelty in a way that's trying to like, it makes me feel less human. And I wrote a whole paper for IFA Doc Labs, 121-page report, and there were some people that were wanting to sort of use AI to basically see if the films that they were making were ethical. And I was like, this is a terrible idea. This is a bad use case for what AI can and cannot do, right? And I spent 15 hours like debunking a bunch of hallucinated bullshit that they used to say, oh, we're going to like feed all of these transcripts into this AI model and we're going to like produce this paper. And here's a research document. I went through it and I spent 15 hours like basically sorting through AI slop. It was so dehumanizing. There's so much crap that's out there that we don't understand the limitations of large language models that we're just like putting a bunch of shit out on the internet, and it's like destroying our civic society. I mean, it's so terrible. Like the internet's dying because we've got so much spammers sending AI everywhere. So like,
so
the
clearly,
degree to which
Ken,
that
you,
was
you
happening
have an opinion
like,
on
oh
this.
My God, what are we doing here?
So, but I think we need to also separate AI misuse and also characterizations by a few people that are leaders in AI, for instance, Sam Altman. I don't think he represents the industry as a whole and all the people who are involved in building it. And he's definitely not the ethical, moral leader for that industry, right? In fact, I think most of what you said about him, I agree with. I don't think he's saying the right things. And I don't think he's actually understands the technology because he's not an AI technologist. He's a VC who became a CEO of a company, okay? And I would rather you look at people like Demis Hassabis, who spent his entire career building AI, trying to make AI create medicines and cure cancer and do those type of things. And he's actually executed on that, right? If you look at Google was first to be kind of the leader in AI. In fact, OpenAI was created as a response to the fear that Google would start to misuse AI, although then OpenAI became the most closed AI. And then you had Anthropic, who was spun out of OpenAI because they were afraid that OpenAI wasn't humanistic enough. And then they created this Anthropic AI. And Anthropic AI is now the power of, you know, the weapons to kill people in our war system. And then you have xAI, who was created as response to OpenAI Anthropic to create more truth AI. And it's now the spreader of the most lies of all the social networks. So it feels like the problem is a lot of the initial intent of these guys, of the people who are building technology, they initially wanted to do good with it. And unfortunately, maybe because of money or power or influence of VCs, they've been misguided and are now under this illusion that by creating AI, they will all become trillionaires, and one of them have become. But I don't think that is a sustainable model, and I don't think that the windfall that Leslie mentioned that they think they're going to get is going to come, because they're essentially creating the tool that will destroy the economy, that will fuel the growth. Those are the kind of things that when you're a pure technology, you don't really understand maybe the geopolitical aspect or the economic aspect of what you're creating, and you take a very simplistic look at it. And when you look at it from a systematic level, these technologies have absolute amazing capability to do good. And it's not just language models, it's models to be able to synthesize materials, to create medicine, to educate children, to do things that would take years of man work to do, kind of grunt work, and to do it in minutes, right? Those are things that actually bring value. And I don't think we want to discount the capabilities of that technology.
I think one of the things we have to do is very consciously reclaim and retain our humanity. I have a friend, she's a screenwriter in LA, and she started using, you know, AI as a tool for stuff, as many of us are doing, everybody maybe in this room except Kent. And then she went and there was some task that she had to do that she had been using AI for. And she realized, oh my God, I'm really rusty at this. And this is bad. And she could kind of feel her brain creaking as she did it. She realized, you know, I have been outsourcing my thinking too long. And so she wrote a blog about this and she termed it, what we need is cognitive fitness. We need to look after our own individual cognitive fitness the same way that we look after our physical fitness. Now, physical fitness as a term didn't exist before, you know, probably the 20th century, because everybody was out working in the fields. And the idea of like getting fat because you're sitting around too much was not a problem until we got very sedentary lifestyles brought to us by the Industrial Revolution and machines. Now we have the problem of being able to outsource a lot of our thinking. So we have to actively maintain our cognitive fitness the same way we need to look after our physical fitness. And I think that's something each of us individually can do. And I think that's the first step in forming the resistance to the kind of autocratic AI-dominated world that both of you fear. My optimism is in humanity, being able to retain its humanity.
Yeah, and I think one way to maintain your mental fitness is to not use AI in a way that, well, so I think there's a way. I don't want to use AI to like write my emails or like, so at IFA Doc Lab this year, there's a piece called Deep Soup, and the creators had written this friction manifesto. And in this friction manifesto, they were saying, you know, we live in a world where technology promises to remove all friction from our lives. But when you do that, you end up kind of destroying civic society in a way that we're not dealing with other human beings anymore in a way that we're not related or connected to each other. And so I think that
friction creates pearls.
What's that?
Friction creates pearls.
Yeah. And so there's a way of like really embracing this sort of friction in a way that, what's it mean to actually like do the hard work to connect to people, to relate to people. And so, yeah, I feel like we're in this weird spot where I don't want to like outsource my thinking, and I want to sort of embrace the different aspects of that friction, because there's a way that AI can like skip to the end. And it's like almost if you were watching a movie, you just like watch the last 2 minutes of a movie. It's like it's the journey that is robbing us of what it means to be human through that. So, you know, there's good uses and bad uses of AI. And I think there's like, for me, I like to see artists using AI, and I like to watch the experiences, and I like to see how it feels in my body, what's good or not. And I think we're all sort of like calibrating our own sense of moral intuition for what feels right or wrong. And I think this is part of what this panel is about, is we're sort of exploring the full spectrum of the promises and perils in a way that I'm hopeful that people will also sort of try to weigh the moral implications of what it means to be using this technology without any guardrails, and that we don't have the sort of, you know, from Lessig's model of pathetic dot theory, you have the culture that is changing the laws, that are changing the economy, that are changing the technological architecture and code. So we don't have the culture right now that has the political will, because we have a political system that has been completely captured with this regulatory capture.
And I think there's a way to achieve the type of journey you're talking about while using AI, because it's not about just abstaining. Right, because I think you said during our earlier chat, you said you're an AI abolitionist.
Well, aiming towards. Right. I kind of want to send AI into a burning sun a lot of times, just because, you know, it's... And I'm not alone. I think if you watch the different lectures of people from the tech industry talking to normal people, this is like the tech industry, so like... But there were people that were booing people talking about AI because they're facing a future where they're not going to own anything. And so the type of future they're facing is like AI that's taking jobs and just like it's...
But Ken, the thing is, if you avoid using it, then you actually become a bigger probability to be a victim of it, right? And you know, in Sun Tzu's Art of War, you have to know yourself and know your enemy. If your enemy is AI and you never use AI, you don't know it and you don't know how to combat it. You don't know how to take advantage of the benefits it does provide while still preventing some of the risks that you're talking about. Because all technology are dual use. All technology are dual-edged swords. And it's your responsibility as the person who's applying it to understand it, to know at what times and how to use it.
I also, just to add to that, I think this idea, there's a lot of people who are anti-AI who essentially become AI denialists, where they deny that superintelligence is possible. They deny that it's really as good as it is. They call everything slop. And I see a lot of that being making themselves feel good rather than confront what is really happening. And I mean, I even still hear people talk about large language models and say they're, you know, stochastic parrots that are just statistical. A large language model is an information processor.
Do you believe that's not true?
It is absolutely not true.
Whoa, okay.
it's absolutely not true, because a large language model is a data processor. An intelligence is a feedback loop around a data processor. Once you put a single feedback loop around a large language model, it is able to behave. And so we're seeing...
But it's still a statistical next probable next word, and it's missing the whole aspect of the Peircean semiotic transmission of meaning, where there's a symbol and a meaning, and then we use an object and a word, and then there's an interpreter that's mediating between the word and the meaning. You're only taking the artifacts of the meaning
You're taking Emily Bender's ideas, which is more... She's more linguist.
And then, she's an expert.
No, she's an expert in linguistics.
Computational linguist is her expertise.
But I think right now what's happening today is going beyond what her understanding of the models are, and that her characterization is no longer representative of the state-of-the-art technology.
And intelligence is a control system.
Well, we don't know, we don't have any transparency of what they're doing, so we actually don't know what they're doing. Well, because they're not actually, if they were transparent and they had, like, this is what we're doing, I'd be fine. But we have no idea, and we have no way to validate.
No, I mean, the training processes are very clear, and most
don't have any
labs
transparency.
Around the world.
There's no transparency of what any of the major, quote-unquote, foundational models are doing.
But does it matter?
Yes,
because
in order to actually validate what they're saying is true, you have to have some way of validating without like having transparency.
Even though the frontier models are not necessarily transparent, the open source models make a lot of that information available. Yeah. Papers are written every day, hundreds of papers a week on this topic that are showing the process and techniques that they're using to train these models. And the data sets that are being provided are also, there's a lot of common data sets. So the level of transparency is there for even small labs right now to build relatively capable models. Right. It is not as black and white.
So there's a difference between real understanding. They don't have comprehensive world models. They don't have like...
Well, there are now like, new architectures that actually have world model type concepts built into them.
But I don't know if it's necessary to have that understanding. Because if we think about the other creatures that are here on the planet with us, I have a dog. I have no idea how my dog processes the world. My dog sees the world more through his nose than through his eyes. What does that mean? What is that like? I got no effing idea. However, I still, if my dog growls, something has alerted me and I will go and I will verify for myself what it is that the dog is growling about. I don't think we need to understand every neuron.
I think people are looking at the output.
Trust something.
I have run into people here that look at the output of large language model and they give them pronouns and they think they're conscious and they think that whatever they're
saying.
We're not
talking about like large.
Yeah. Well, but I'm just saying as an example, they're talking to the large language model as if the large language model is actually understanding anything that they're saying, and they don't. They don't understand anything. They're just repeating contextual. They're responding to contextual window inputs.
One of the big problems that I think is damaging to the community of people who really want to resist AI and are against AI is that they equate it with a large language model and they rely on a 5-year-old paper that was questionable about stochastic paratree. When if you look at just the evolution of intelligence, the way intelligence evolved was from very simple organisms that can sense and react with a control system. And intelligence is a control system. And the systems that all of the large manufacturers are making right now, they're using a large language model as a processor of language and of information and also of images and other sensor data, but it's the control system around that gives this AI initial rudimentary agency, and that's accelerating very, very quickly. We're rapid path where AI systems are getting more and more agency. They're behaving. They're not just processing data. And there's a lot of people out there who think, oh, we're safe because it's a stochastic parrot. Yeah. We're not.
It's just sticking your hand in the sand right now. The reality is that the harnesses now are maybe even more valuable in terms of their ability to help provide long-term memory, to provide the execution capability, to be able to route to different tools. Those type of capabilities are allowing these systems, whether or not you call it understanding, it is able to do very, very complex tasks that was not imaginable just a few years ago. And to restrict it to a several-year-old concept of a single standalone large language model at the time, which were very tiny models today, right? I don't think it is representative of reality that we have.
But I think if we had actual transparency with open models, that I think we'd be able to test these things. Everything you're saying is like, these are all so occluded. Maybe people within these AI companies, maybe you're one of them, Lewis, that has deeper insight. But most of this stuff that we're talking about, if it was in an open model, like, I went to the International Joint Conference of Artificial Intelligence in 2016, 2018, and did about 122 interviews with AI researchers. And what I was hearing is that there's this machine learning bottom-up approach, and then the sort of all these other, knowledge representation and like constraints and planning and robotics, all the sort of more top-down heuristics that at the time AlphaGo was using, like hierarchical tree search with the sort of deep reinforcement learning, but it was a top-down and bottom-up. And that part of what Gary Marcus is arguing is that we need sort of more neurosymbolic cognitive architectures that are more sophisticated. And I think part of what you're saying, Alvin, is that we're having that. But
yeah, I mean,
again,
and then the neural side is the language models. Together, you create a neurosymbolic system, right?
Yeah, and that the problem I have is that we don't have any transparency of that. So we don't actually have ways of validating it independently. And so that's a part of like,
there's four brains on this stage. There's no way to validate them.
Yeah.
There's no transparency.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that the claims that are made in terms of these benchmark, which is part of the argument that Emily and Binder and Alex Hanna made, is that there's this benchmarking kind of ethos of like you put a number and you quantify it, and then that becomes like the full, like the empirical checks and balance. And that there's the AI researcher said that there's actually more empirical driven results than theoretical results, meaning that they're doing things to tweak it to have the number go up, but they don't actually have some deep understanding as to what's happening.
Well, if you use these systems, which I think actually you should, because
I actually have, but it will go ahead.
No.
Back what I have.
Well, I mean, but not just use it lightly, but to use it deeply. I think the more you use it, the more you really appreciate what it's actually capable of. Whether or not, again, there's understanding or there's consciousness, those are very debatable. But whether or not it has ability to take complex tasks is not just about giving a probabilistic response. I think that misunderstanding is in the root of a lot of people who are essentially, like you're saying, the AI deniers, right? And I think we really need to think about, how do we take something that is capable of these things and make good with it? That should be the real question we should be
Because it already exists. We can't fight
Yeah, and it's not going to go away.
Right.
Yeah.
So how do we turn it to our advantage
and
to our good? That's really the question.
So actually, let me kind of switch the process a little bit. I would like each of you to say one thing that you agree with the person on the opposite side of your seating. So we'll start with Leslie. What do you agree with what Ken's saying?
I agree with his choice of shirt today. That's a very nice shirt. let's see. Well, I appreciate your concerns. I hear where your concerns are coming from. You know, and there is an advantage to being off the grid, whichever grid you happen to be talking about. And I can see not wanting to open up your data to all kinds of potentially nefarious actors. That's, I think, a very natural response. For me, where I differ with you is that the advantages for me outweigh what I perceive the risks to be. And maybe it's because I am arrogantly thinking that whatever AI might do to me, I can overcome with my powerful human brain. Because it still is a powerful human brain. And our carbon-based ability to reason will always be different from silicon ability to reason. And that's great. That's great. I think, and it's us working together, carbon and silicon together, is where we're actually going to find some really amazing things for all of us. And I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
I just want to say one thing in terms of, for a long time, I was using WhisperX, which is an open source modification from OpenAI's Whisper, which does speech to text. I have 1,714 podcasts I've published. And so for 96% of them, they have transcripts. But I start having people come up to me saying, hey, you know, these are not like corrected. And so it gets maybe 90, 95% of it correct. And it's enough for me to search and find stuff. But there's a way in which that people were saying, you know, like, misspelled my name, it got this wrong. It would take me as long to correct the transcript as it would for me to just do the transcript. And so it's this trade-off between, okay, I want to provide the accessibility, but it's also like all of this other stuff. And I've also had people from the Global South come up and say, you know, absolutely no, do not have auto transcripts because it will absolutely get what we say wrong. So there is a way in which that even things like this auto transcription will sort of get things in a way that the people are already harmed are getting even more harm because it's not accurately reflecting what they're saying. So I have used it enough to know, like, there's a sense of, like, for me, understanding where good use cases and bad use cases. And, like, so whenever there's an empirical feedback loop where you know there's a right answer of, like, in a Boolean reality, then AI can do well. But whenever it has, like, dealing with information and knowledge, it hallucinates in a way that's uncontrollable and you don't know when it's right or wrong, and there's no way for you to actually accurately understand. It's like a halting problem where it can't understand where it's misunderstanding.
So what do you agree with, Leslie?
Oh,
sound like agreement there.
Well, you know, so Leslie was sharing this experience of being in France and having like a medical condition where it's in a foreign country, so didn't know how to navigate the medical system. So the fact that she was able to find utility and actually save her vision is actually a great example of the use of AI. I'm sort of in an anti-AI position in a performative sense where I do think there are human rights and certain use cases. So that's one of the examples of a good use case. And there's also accessibility, and I've used AI to anonymize people who are anonymous and I don't want to reveal their identity, so I've given their voice. And so I think there's a sense of like, what are the good and bad use cases of AI, but also the harms and risks that are there. And so that's sort of like where, you know, we don't have the guardrails, and we don't have the political climate to actually have any guardrails. And so we're basically sleepwalking into what is essentially going to be for the next foreseeable 10 to 20 years of companies doing whatever they want. We're basically sleepwalking into a surveillance capitalism mashed up with authoritarianism. That's where I differ, where I think that risk is actually...
I don't differ with you on that because, heck, I'm the one who's moving back to Europe.
Well, I guess the difference is that I choose...
You're in a place where there are guardrails.
Get the heck out, yeah.
The difference is that I choose not to participate in AI because of that. And I think that's where we differ.
Yeah. Although I think the guardrails are coming, and they have to come. If not, there's going to be mass unrest. So, but let's go to Lewis. What do you agree with this side of the?
So, I'll agree with both sides. So I agree with Kent that we really have to preserve and stand up for humanity, and I agree with what Leslie said, which is that ultimately we need to have, you know, humans and AIs working together, and that human thought is very different. I think it's foundationally different. And I think that's one of the problems is people do anthropomorphize AI to make themselves believe it is acting human. It's acting very different. It thinks very differently, but that doesn't mean it won't be smarter than us. And so, you know, I very much see a future where we are outmatched by AI. I don't like that. I'm not a proponent of that, but I'm not going to deny it and ignore it. And I think we need to be planning of what, you know, how do we humans stay relevant in a world where there is super intelligence at scale? As I said, you know, I've spent the last 12 years running an AI company as somebody who is terrified of AI. And the reason I do that is I have focused for the last 12 years on the pursuit of collective superintelligence, where it is humans connected at scale with AI to create a superintelligence where human values, human morals, human sensibilities, and human interests are inherent in the system. 12 years in, I still believe it's possible, but I also think that AI is moving so fast that anything can happen, and we could just find ourselves left behind by superintelligence. And I think it's a genuinely real risk, and I wish it wasn't.
Yeah. Alvin, where do you agree with?
I'm going to say where I agree with all of you guys is one is, I think Kent really hits the nail on the head in terms of the humanization aspect of it. And I think there is an opportunity to preserve our humanness, to preserve our agency while using this technology. I think this is the key, is that you want to try to make that happen. And you know, in fact, I wrote a paper about how to preserve agency in this age of AI, right? And in terms of with what Lewis just said, I am also a great proponent that these technologies are going to surpass us in a lot of different ways. Like, nobody's going to say, hey, this tractor, it'll never be as strong as me, or, you know, this plane will never fly as fast as me, or whatever, right? There are certain things that machines can do that are just going to be better because it has more capability.
That's why we built them in the first place.
Yeah. So. But then we also need to understand there are things that uniquely we are doing, the relational aspect of how we treat each other, of how we connect with each other, right? And you're not going to connect with a machine, probably not. Maybe some people will, but most people will not. It's in the same way they do to another human, right? You're not going to care for it the same way. And I think those are the kind of things that we need to think about. How do we provide more service to society? How do we provide more, I guess, more kindness to others? I think those are the kind of things that machines will not innately be built to do.
How do we get the big companies to care about people?
So, and then to what Leslie's talking about in terms of government's role, I think this is really the key, is the government right now has the biggest responsibility to create the framework and the environment for it to be used properly. And if it is, then all of the fears, or many of the fears that Kent has, will probably can be alleviated. And many of the benefits that Leslie's talking about can actually be realized. So we, you know, it's our job right now as individuals to make sure that we voice our opinions to the government, to policymakers. And I've been trying to do this for the last couple of years and finding that they're actually more receptive than they have ever been. I will tell you, in the last 3 months, the receptivity to that concept is completely different. And what we also see is that online, because of things that, you know, Kent said, these booing at the commencement talks, people are realizing that there is a backlash to the current approach that we're taking to AI, and the governments who want to stay in power want to make sure that they alleviate these issues for their constituency.
Yeah, and I think maybe if we have some closing thoughts and open for a question. I have one thing I wanted to say, which is that I don't foresee always being against AI in a way that I am currently. I choose not to use it in a way that it's not in right relationship. And I think that's a key part. AI and VR and XR, they're all this provocation for us to have a fundamental philosophical paradigm shift into something I identify as like process philosophy, which is, how do we become in right relationship to the technologies around us? How do we have the data acquisition and not data colonialism? How do we relate to the AI in the world around us in a way that doesn't have surveillance capitalism and has privacy protections? And so I think those are the different types of things where, if we're in right relationship, there are some good use cases for AI. And we have to recognize that AI as a technology can have this potential for emancipatory and liberation power. However, at the same time, it's a tool of consolidation of wealth and power. And so recognizing that this is a dual reality that we have right now, and that how do we take in all the advantages and receive that, but also weigh against this consolidation of wealth and power in a way that doesn't just have this sort of hyperscalers taking over everything. So I think open source is actually a great antidote to that. And so if I am going to use AI, it's going to be an open source model.
That I totally agree with. Actually, before we do our summary, can I see if there's any questions? We do have 7 minutes. So just maybe 3 or 4 questions. I'd love to hear what the audience wants to know more about.
We've got a microphone over there. Oh, and the lights just came up. Oh, look at that.
Go ahead, please.
So I'm wondering, and Lewis, this may be most close to what Unanimous AI has been doing, but do you see an opportunity for the barriers between our individualistic engagement with the world actually being eroded in a way that could be positive, more distributed consciousness, something kind of sci-fi futuristic, telepathy, something that radically shifts the way that we can engage and respond to one another coming from these technologies?
So it is related to what I work on, and what I focus on right now is enabling communication among human groups at scale. So enabling 1,000 people to have a conversation, or potentially even 10,000 people to have a conversation, as a way to really capture, harness, amplify the collective intelligence of large groups. And humans are really, really smart. When you connect them together, we become super intelligent compared to individuals. Whether that goes to telepathy, at that level, you know, there are people who envision a world where we all have brain implants, and then we're communicating that way. You know, I think that the risks of brain implants do not... The risks greatly outweigh the benefits because if we are already worried about manipulation with wearing AI on your face, with an AI whispering in your ears, if we have an AI pumping voices directly into our brain, I think it's all over.
Yeah, you'll have no idea who's programming you. Next question.
Hi, everyone. I'm Darius, and I'm a recovering high school teacher. And I'm here to represent teenagers, I think, who have a foot in this game that we're talking about here. And I really like the idea of confronting the actual issues that we're trying to talk about here. We've been talking in the abstract, but now what can I ask a teenager to do to prepare to get ready for one of these many futures that you're talking about? And it seems to me literature has been a way that allows the people to see and choose from possibilities to change our social conscience, like Animal Farm in 1984, Uncle Tom's Cabin, or Bambi, or Silent Spring. And it feels like we're at that point where instead of abstractions, we need a narrative to describe all these worlds you are talking about, to describe all the choices I, or more importantly, the teenagers I help prepare for this future world you're describing. So the real question is, where is our Kobayashi Maru simulation that I can take the teenagers in to role play all those situations to make wise, intelligent, actual choices to bring the better future you're describing? Who's building the Kobayashi Maru? Where is it? How can I get my teenagers into it?
Yeah, I'm not sure if a particular simulation is necessarily the right answer. I feel like the responsibility of parenting is actually with the parents, and rather than relying on, you know, teachers or the education system. And if you teach your children well in terms of how to think systematically and, you know, from first principles and to have, like you're saying, reading more and understanding history and morals and philosophy, they will be able to decipher a little bit more about how to use and how to leverage this technology to make them grow, to help them grow, versus being reliant on it. So I actually gave a talk on this at the Trinity School a couple months ago. If you can do a search for it, it's a half-hour talk about specifically to a high school audience of what they need to be doing to prepare for what's coming. Right? Maybe one more.
I think the concept of cognitive fitness, as the parents of teenagers myself, is very important. Don't always ask AI to do your math for you. Actually get out a pencil and paper.
Yeah. And this side?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Brian Gillis. I'm a proud Long Beach native and volunteer at this year. There's a price to be paid for every technological advancement, and I apologize because I'm going to sound a lot like Kent when I say this. The World Wide Web took away our access to libraries, more or less, yes? And the smartphone took away our attention span from reality, and social media made us less interested in our local society. And as you climb, it becomes more detrimental. AI is removing our ability to be intellectuals, and agentic AI is taking away our agency. And this isn't just my viewpoint. There's this niche art house film that's part of the Criterion Collection. Maybe you've seen. It's animated, where a large corporation leverages superintelligence. It destroys the world, and then it's saved by robots. It's called WALL-E. And so, if you love AI as we all do, you must be worried that something bad will happen soon. If for the first time ever, the youth demographic, right? We just had someone that's a high school teacher. For the first time ever, this Gen Beta, their scholastic scores have gone down, where parents are now more intelligible than their youth. And if that is something we have graphical evidence to provide, and they were raised in the era of accessible artificial intelligence, it's not up to big tech to fix that. It's up to us. And if we don't stop using it for everything, how are we not going to be able, or rather unable, of doing everything ourselves?
Yeah, so I might challenge that a little bit in the sense of you're saying the technology is doing these things to us. I think it's really the system that the technology has been put into is creating the results that you're talking about, right? So the internet did not take away the libraries. Actually, there are plenty of libraries. The people is, in fact, I think the internet makes almost every single piece of literature available to everybody on Earth that was now 6 or 7 billion people that would not have had that access to. The social network did not take away our attention. It is the algorithms of advertising that took away our attention because it's used to make us be more engaged, right? So if the law was there to say, you know, make social networks that help people learn more and communicate more, but not necessarily be engaged in terms of just clicking and scrolling, then you're going to get a very different result. So the technology itself is not bad. It's who's driving it and what motives is behind that. So
back to guardrails.
I think the problem isn't necessarily even the motives of who's driving it. I think the problem is the rate of change. We did not evolve to live in a world that changes this fast.
Yes.
And so, of course, we're going to end up with bad systems because a good system evolves slowly that adapts to what we need. And the rate of change is only getting faster. And so we had the question come up from the high school teacher, what do you say to kids? I mean, that's a tough question because their world is changing faster than anyone's world. How do you plan for a future when it's changing this fast? And I wish there was a way to slow it down, and there really isn't, but I think it all boils down to the rate of change creating bad outcomes.
Okay, I think we're running out of time, but I wanted to do one last thing. Is one thing that has changed your mind in the last hour? So, Kent?
Start with me. I don't know if I've changed my mind about anything. Well, come back to me.
Okay, so Leslie, why don't we start on this side?
I don't know that my mind has been changed in the last hour.
Oh.
But I will say something that has been, my mind has been changed about something that we didn't really touch on in the last year. And that's kind of the corporate approach to firing everybody and replacing them with AI. Because Alvin, again, this comes from your paper where you talk about China's approach, where they are, as the government policy is, they've chosen 6 different industries and they're full on advancing them towards using AI, but it's also illegal to fire someone in China and replace them with AI. That's actually a great idea.
Okay.
And so we've built a wall between us and China on AI, and I think we need to take that wall down.
I agree with that. So, Lewis.
I mean, I'm really happy that the conversation turned to the next generation and kids. And again, I think, I don't know if it changed my opinion, but it reminded me of the challenge that this generation faces, which is easy to forget because it's so different than anything probably most people in this room faced when they were graduating from high school.
Okay.
There was a documentary called The AI Doc that was like the AI doomers, the AI accelerationists, some ethicists, and I feel like you watch it and you're like, oh, what is going to happen? I feel like the thing that I want to emphasize is that we do have the agency to be able to bring about change. And I feel like even though the political context feels like it's impossible for change to happen now, but that we can hold in our creative imagination the possibility of being in right relationship with AI in a way that would satisfy what I think would be ethical. But as of right now, I think it's like completely unethical in so many different ways. I still choose to abstain personally, but that doesn't mean that other people have to make other choices based upon their context. But I would just request people to listen to their own moral intuition and to weigh the full spectrum of what these technologies imply of both the emancipatory liberation aspects, but also the harms of the consolidation of wealth and power we see with AI.
So one last word is, there's something called the 3.5% rule. I don't know if you guys heard about it, but Erica Chenoweth did this research that showed over the last 120 years and 300 plus demonstrations that if more than 3.5% of a population of a country or a region peacefully protests, that change can happen. And I think, you know, this
and
is
in the
a
U.S.,
topic.
That's 12 million people.
Yeah, with 12 million people is very, very accessible to us. And I think we are now at a point where this technology deserves for us to pay that level of attention. And if there are things that, and I think a lot of what Kent is talking about makes sense. And if we care about it, then we should voice that opinion and make change. So thank you for your time. I think we are out of time.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.